to be aimed at various Gentile kingdoms, various non-Jewish kingdoms. They're all prefaced with the word the burden. This is the burden of, and then these various kingdoms. These nations all happen to be, coincidentally, nations who at some time have persecuted Israel. So it's kind of fascinating, interesting. Some have suggested that God wants to make sure that his people understand that he works beyond their borders. That he works in the ways and the affairs of all nations. The current prophecy that we start in chapter 13 is going to be centered around a time period that is identified in verses 6 and 9. It's identified as the day of the Lord. Now, we've talked about this before. We saw this back in chapter 2 of Isaiah. The day of the Lord. This is a specific biblical phrase. The day of the Lord. It's funny how we miss some certain things. You know, we always say, "This is the day that the Lord hath made." That the Lord, and we say, "Well, today's the day the Lord has made. I will rejoice in God." But you realize in Psalm 118, when it talks about that, it's talking about a specific day. You know, it's the specific day that Jesus would come in. Well, here, the day of the Lord is talking about a specific day. Now, it is used in three different ways. It is used what we would say historically about things that have already taken place. They would be future to these folks. But talking about a time when God would enter into the affairs of a nation or people. And that would be their day. This is God's day for them. The day of the Lord. It is used at times. It will be used like in the prophecies in Joel chapter 2. Prophecies about things that will happen twice. It's kind of like reruns. There will be a prophecy that will happen at some time near the time of the prophet. And then it skips way off into the future. There are also times where the day of the Lord is used specifically, and this is the most common use of it, is that it is used to talk about the end times. Starting after the rapture of the church, when we go get zippity-doo-dot up into heaven, and it is the time of the great tribulation period, 7 years of hell on earth, Jesus comes back and then rules and reigns for 1,000 years. All of that is called the day of the Lord. That's all called the day of the Lord. Now, chapter 13, I am becoming convinced, is in which category? Chapter 13, it used to be people thought it was the first category, just something that's already happened. I am becoming more and more convinced that it is the second type. It is a double fulfillment. It is going to be talking about things that are just around the corner for Isaiah, but it's also going to be talking about things that are in our future. And in fact, gosh, there's some stuff in here that's like, ooh, it's very close. I'm reading the newspaper here. Okay. Because it's got a double fulfillment, we're going to go through this chapter twice. Okay? I don't know how I'm going to do this and still get communion in tonight, this morning. That's because tonight we'll get communion in tonight. No. We're going to try to go through it twice. We're going to go through the chapter first, looking at the near fulfillment. The fulfillment that will be right around the corner from Isaiah. The prophecy against the fall, about the fall of Babylon, the conquering of Babylon by the Medes and the Persians. We'll look at it once through here, and then we'll come back and see how that's close, but not all of it. And we'll come back and pick up some other stuff. So chapter 13, verse 1. This is called the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amoz, did see. It's called the burden of Babylon. Now, some of your translations will call it the oracle, maybe the prophecy of Babylon. Actually, King James is not all that bad. It calls it the burden because that's the sense of the Hebrew word. It's something heavy. Now, it is a prophecy. It is an oracle, something about the future, but it's something that's heavy. There's going to be 10 burdens through the next 10, 11 chapters. They're all talking about judgment. They're talking about heavy things. Judgment is very serious. Judgment is very serious. It's something that we don't like to talk about. But you know what? It's real. It's coming. And you ought to be aware of it. You ought to be aware of it. I mean, you know, when you're in school and you're taking, you know, some English class or something, you want to know when the semester final is, right? And you may be a person like me who tend to put things off, you know, to then my mom's laughing and stuff, but I put things off until the day before the exam to even crack open a book or something. But you know what? You can even pretend that the exam's not going to happen, but you know what? It will happen. Whether you like it or not, the exam will come. Judgment is real. It's not something we love to talk about, but it's real. And you ought to be prepared for it. The burden of Babylon. In the Hebrew, the name that's translated here, Babylon, the Hebrew is actually simply the word Babel. Babel. You remember Genesis 11, the Tower of Babel? Same place. Means confusion. This is the Hebrew name for the place. The Greeks called it Babylon. It is a city, an ancient city, about 65 kilometers south of modern Baghdad, the capital of Iraq. It is on the river Euphrates. This is a real place. This is the burden of Babylon. Now keep in mind, something else to keep in mind historically, to get the context, Isaiah is writing around 700 BC. Babylon won't become a great world empire for at least another 100 years or so. Right now, it's an important city. It's Toledo, Ohio, or something like that. You know, but it's an important place. People live there and all, but it's like nothing special yet. So it's kind of fascinating that he picks Babylon out. Because it's not the world empire that we think, look back and think of Babylon. This is before it became great. The burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz did see. Lift ye up a banner upon the high mountain. Exalt the voice unto them. Shake the hand, you know, wave the hand. Wave them over that they may go into the gates of the nobles. This is like a cry out to those who will come and demolish Babylon. The idea, you stick a banner up on a hill so everybody can see the signal, it's time to attack. You know, wave these people and we're going to charge and enter into Babylon. Verse 3, I have commanded my sanctified ones, I have also called my mighty ones for mine anger, even them that rejoice in my highness. Now, it says, I've commanded my sanctified ones. He's talking about the armies of the Medes who will conquer Babylon. And he's calling them his sanctified ones. The Hebrew word is kadash, which means holy. We often would translate this word, my holy ones. It says, I have commanded my holy ones. The word holy simply is the idea of being set apart for somebody's use. And God is calling these Medes his set of part ones. He's got their number. They're going to be used by him. Now we saw in Isaiah 10 that God called the Assyrian Empire his rod and his staff. See, God uses unbelievers. He's going to use these Medes. He calls them my sanctified ones. I have also called my mighty ones. But verse 4, the noise of a multitude in the mountains, like as of a great people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts mustereth the host of the battle. He brings the armies together. That's the word host means the armies. God's hand is involved in history. God's hand is involved in history. I don't know about you, but times like we're going through right now, if you've been reading the newspapers, things that are going on in Europe right now. Every once in a while, I remember thinking this back, you know, in the Vietnam days and the Cold War days, and, you know, when we remember duck and cover, get a, you know, and we talk about what are we going to do if a nuclear bomb hits, and, you know, what if some madman presses the button and wipes us all out? I got to tell you, God's hand is on history. Things don't happen by accident. God calls these people out. They will do what He says. God is involved. Verse 5, it says, they come from a far country, from the end of heaven, even the Lord, and the weapons of His indignation to destroy the whole land. So it tells us where the direction of these armies are going to come from that will wipe out Babylon. We'll look at a map of Babylon in a minute. It says they come from a far country. The Medes were about 350 miles away from Babylon, about 350 miles to the east. It says they will come from the end of heaven. This is something, a new trivia thing I picked up. Psalm 19, verse 6, David describes the course of the sun going through the heavens, and he says it comes from, he uses the same phrase, it will come from the end of heaven. Where does the sun come up? Hello, are you awake with me? Where does the sun come up, gang? It comes from the east, okay? So the idea of these people will come from far away from the east. And that's where the Medes were located, 300 miles to the east of Babylon. Verse 6, howl ye, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It shall come as a destruction from the Almighty. Therefore shall all hands be faint, and every man's heart shall melt. That was interesting. The night that Babylon was taken, we read about this in Daniel chapter 5. The night that Babylon was taken, the people were actually not scared at first. Because, see, they'd been surrounded by Cyrus and his armies of Medes. They were surrounded. But they had nothing to worry about because nobody could take Babylon. I mean, nobody could come across our walls and our defenses and everything. And so they were having a party. It was party time. Nebuchadnezzar and 1,000 of his lords, they were just having a party. You know, a drunken orgy. And a hand appears from nowhere and begins to write on the wall. Well, Daniel records at that time the king went nuts. I mean, it says his knees knocked together, and I think it almost meant something like he wet his pants or something. Believe me, they were terrified from that moment on. Verse 8, and they shall be afraid. Pangs and sorrow shall take hold of them. They shall be in pain as a woman that travaileth. They shall be amazed one at another. Their faces shall be as flames. Some translations say their faces will be on fire. Verse 9, behold, the day of the Lord cometh, cruel both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and He shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. The wrath of God. It will be cruel both with wrath and fierce anger. Now, we talked about this last week. And I want to make sure that we've got the right concept here. God is not having a bad day. See, too often we put on God our problems. You know, I act certain ways, so you know, I look at these things, you know, I know what it's like when the wrath of daddy. Now the kids know about the wrath of daddy, you know, and they understand, you know, sometimes daddy's just in a bad mood and you just don't go near him, you know, and they stay away from daddy, you know. You know what? That's not the way God's wrath is. It's not about God having a bad day.
Oh, good bad hair day. I'll take it out and wipe this nation out.
The wrath of God is the appropriate response to our sin. It has to do with God's justice. See, we understand that. If you think about it, I mean, when you read about these, you know, you pick up the paper and you look at some of the horrible crimes going on around. You know, you read, I remember years back, remember the David Rothenberg thing where the guy set his own son on fire? Remember that? How horrible that was? And you read about that and you go, man, somebody's got to pay for that. Well, you're right. You are right. Someone has to pay for that. The wrath of God has to do with making things right. You know, people say, well, how long can these people get away with this? Well, you know what? God's being patient, but there will be a day where they won't get away with it, and they will have to pay. This is the wrath of God. This is what this day of the Lord is all about. It's about making things right. You know, this thing isn't fair. That thing's not fair. It will be fair. God will make it all fair one day. This is His wrath. Also keep in mind, precious ones, when we talk about the wrath of God, when you read passages like this, understand that the warnings always come hundreds of years before the hammer hits. I had this concept as a kid somehow. I don't know. I think it's probably from watching too many cartoons or something. I don't know. I had this concept that God was this old guy with a big white beard sitting up on some stone slab up in heaven with a big hammer. And you just do something wrong, because he's got his eye on you, you know. You do one thing wrong and boom! You know, boom! Gotcha! You know, just did something wrong, boom! Smack you upside the head. No, hold on here, gang. The Bible says that God is slow to anger. He is slow to anger. And so when we read about things like this, oh my gosh, the warning is going out here, 700 BC. Babylon won't be wiped out till 539 BC is when they will be conquered. God is very patient. We need to understand these things when we look and discuss the wrath of God. Verse 10. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. And that's interesting. The word that's translated constellations, the Hebrew word is kasil. And we often translate it constellation, or it is also often translated Orion. It's specifically talking about one constellation, Orion. That's the guy with the belt, Orion's belt. Orion is the hunter, is what the Greeks call them, Orion. And so this is, in Hebrew, the word is kasil, and we're talking about this one constellation, actually, not shining. Interesting thing about this must be the Jewish sense of humor. Well, first I got to tell you, Orion, I think, is Greek. It's either Greek or Roman. In Babylon, he was known as Nimrod. Nimrod's like the founder of Babylon. He became like their chief god. Okay, that's one thing to keep in mind. So we're talking about something very Babylonish here. Okay, it's like, Nimrod. The other thing is this. This is what's so funny about the Hebrew sense of humor. I love it. Love the Jews. Love it. The word means fool. they knew what the constellation was. They called it fool, stupid one, arrogant one. I'm sorry. Okay. Pass. Move on. I just thought this was funny. Okay. Move on. Verse 11. I will punish the world for their evil and the wicked for their iniquity, and I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease, and I will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I will make a man more precious than fine gold, even a man more than the golden wedge of Ophir. Ophir was a distant place they would go to for gold. Some people think it was either on the east coast of Africa, maybe as far as India. And it says, a man more precious than gold. Some of us are not nudging our wives, say, see, honey, I'm worth something, you know. Actually, what it means is it means a man will be as scarce, more scarce than pure gold. And, you know, I was thinking about this in light of what's going on in Yugoslavia right now. And from what I understand, all the refugees that are coming across the border are women and children. Because they're taking all the guys that are army age, supposedly, and killing them. Man will be scarcer than fine gold. We get a little picture of what that's about why this is like this. You see what I'm saying? It's because they're going to wipe out all the men. Just like what we're seeing happening. I'm not trying to say that what's happening is this. I'm saying this is a picture. This is a very good illustration of it. Verse 13. Therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall be removed out of her place, in the wrath of the Lord of hosts and in the day of his fierce anger. And it, talking about Babylon, it, Babylon shall be as the chaste roe, or literally a gazelle. You know, when you go to a wild animal park, the gazelles are the ones that you blink and they run. You know, they're just so terrified. They're so timid. And as a sheep that no man taketh up, the idea of a sheep without a shepherd. Nobody's going to care about these people. They're just going to be running loose. They shall every man turn to his own people and flee everyone unto his own land. Everyone that is found shall be thrust through, you know, javelin sticking out. And everyone that is joined unto them shall fall by the sword. Their children also shall be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses shall be spoiled and their wives ravished. Now, we've talked a little bit about this idea of God's wrath, about justice. Interesting passage in Psalm 137, verses 8 and 9. It says this. The writer of the psalm says this: O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stones. Now, obviously, this is not somebody who's learning to turn the other cheek. We are like that, aren't we? We have a hard time. We want to say, God, go get him. And so you see that in the Psalms. That's a human response. But the point is this. Babylon will be getting what's due them. They will, you know, what goes around comes around. How you treat others is how you'll be treated. This is a part of justice, judgment. Verse 17. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, which shall not regard silver, and as for gold, they shall not delight in it. Now, I mentioned about how at this time Babylon wasn't even that great of an empire. Well, guess what? The Medes weren't all that great either. They were just, you know, this group of people out there. And so this is, again, an incredible thing. The Medes would become a world empire, but not until after the Babylonians, after even the Babylonians. This is an amazing thing that even mentions the Medes would come against them. And it says, they shall not regard silver. This was the historian Xenophon records that this is a characteristic of the Medes. They couldn't be bought off. You know, and so they come up to the gates of Babylon and the king will say, well, we'll pay you $500 million, just go away. And they'll say, no way, buddy. You're dust. You know, and they couldn't be bought off. Verse 18, their bows also shall dash the young men to pieces. It was the Medo-Persian Empire, the Persian part of it. These guys were excellent bowmen. And they shall have no pity on the fruit of the womb, their eyes shall not spare children. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' excellency, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. So Babylon will be, it says, as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, some of the commentaries were saying stuff like, well, you see, it just means that they're going to be completely conquered. Because you have a hard time reconciling this with history. 539 B.C., King Cyrus conquered Babylon. He did it in a very unusual way. He diverted the river Euphrates, which was this huge river that ran right through the middle of the city, had these bronze bars go down into the river so nobody could get in. The river went right through the city, and what he did was he diverted the river. So the river dried up, and somebody had forgot to lock the gates. And so he marched his armies underneath on the dry riverbed, right through the gates and captured the city. It was one of those victories where hardly a shot is fired. Not a lot of people died. They just turned over the keys of the city to him. They were so blown away. It wasn't wiped out. In fact, it became their capital. In fact, in 323 B.C., when Alexander the Great would go and conquer the Persians, Alexander made Babylon his capital. It was still the great capital of the world in 323 BC. And it's already been conquered by the Medes and Persians. Now, to me, that doesn't sound like Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, you know, when I think of Sodom and Gomorrah, I think of it's a fire, brimstone, boom, boom, you know, that stuff. You know, we watch these cameras take these laser-guided things, and you watch the building, and all of a sudden, boom, it blows up. That's kind of Sodom and Gomorrah to me. That's what I think of this thing. It's interesting that Jeremiah prophesies the destruction of Babylon. Now, Jeremiah writes a couple hundred years after Isaiah. He writes during the time when Babylon was great. And in Jeremiah 51:8, he says that it will be overthrown suddenly and destroyed. John records in Revelation 18:10 that it will be judged in 1 hour. Now, John wrote when there was no more Babylon. Babylon had already been destroyed. And yet they're talking about Babylon getting destroyed again. Huh? To me, it sounds like they're all talking about the same thing. We'll talk about this as we go through the second time. Verse 20, it says, "It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation, neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherds make their fold there." Now it says it won't be inhabited. Now up until about 15 years ago, this was true. And that's why you pick up any commentary more than 15 years old, and they'll talk about, well,
and see, to this day, nobody lives in Babylon.
Well, that's true. It ain't true anymore. We'll talk about that in a minute. Verse 21, "But wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, and owls," or better, ostriches, "shall dwell there, and satyrs," or better translation, wild goats, shaggy goats, "shall dance there. And the wild beasts of the islands," or hyenas, "shall cry in their desolate houses," and King James says dragons. A better translation, as others say, is jackals in their pleasant places, "and her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged." I don't know if you picked them out, but there's some things that just don't quite fit with what happened in 539 BC. We talked about the total destruction of the city. Well, it was a gradual thing. By 20 BC, the historian Strabo records that there's nothing left. It's a waste place. So it would happen eventually to be wiped out. But it wasn't a sudden wiping out. I don't know if you picked up on the things about the sun and moon being dark. Oh, my gosh, folks, that's Revelation 6. That's the tribulation. The things, "I will shake the heavens and the earth." Those are also signs of the tribulation period. Let's go back to the beginning. The burden of Babylon. The name Babylon is actually used several ways in the Bible. It is used for a real historical city, the one we see on the Euphrates River. It is also used to describe, in Revelation 17, it's used to describe false religion. Babylon, the mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Some people have done some research and found that probably most every goofy religious thing that's not true comes out of Babylon. There's also another possible use in Revelation 18 that could be seen to describe the world system as it is today. Commercial Babylon, we call it. But the interesting thing is, I just wonder if it couldn't even apply to all three. In the late 1980s, Saddam Hussein, our buddy, started a project to rebuild the city of Babylon. By 1986, the work was supervised by Muyaad Said, head of Iraq's Antiquities Department. By 1986, they'd already rebuilt Nebuchadnezzar's palace. Saddam's goal is to rebuild the glorious Babylon. In an article dated September, this is ABC News article, dated September last year, 1998, Mr. Saeed is talking about how they're in discussions trying to decide whether this one excavation is or is not the famous Tower of Babel, because they're thinking about rebuilding it.
Ooh.
See, what's interesting is that, you know, 15 years ago, we look at this, we say, oh, chapter 13's already been fulfilled. You know, things that don't quite fit, well, you know, the Sodom and Gomorrah, it just means they were really conquered really bad. You know, I wonder. Verse 3 says, I have commanded my sanctified ones. I think that's interesting. My holy ones. I don't know, make whatever you want out of that words. Verse 4. The noise of a multitude, put that in your hopper. The noise of a multitude in the mountains, like as of a great people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts mustereth, the host of the battle. Nations gathered together against Babylon. I think it's very interesting how our last couple of wars have been with groups of nations, huh? It's not just like one lone ranger going out and doing something. You know, we've got, the whole thing is now, if you're president, you've got to build your coalition before you attack, kind of a thing. Look at Revelation 17, verse 16. Revelation 17, verse 16. In one of the descriptions of Babylon's fall, it's Revelation 17, look at verse 16, it says this. The ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, the ten horns that thou sawest on the beast is a description of the Antichrist. The ten horns are ten nations that will be in a confederacy in that day under the Antichrist. We know from Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 that those ten nations will be a restored form of the Roman Empire. A restored form of the Roman Empire. And it says, in what he's saying, and the whore, this is, that's the chapter, Revelation 17's description of the Babylon, is the whore sitting on the beast. He's saying that these ten kings will destroy the beast. Destroy the whore, Babylon. These ten nations will destroy Babylon. You know, I remember years ago we were all excited about counting how many numbers of nations were in the common market. You know, oh, there's nine nations, there's going to be one more. Oh man, Jesus is coming back. You know, now there's something like 15 or 16, you know. And it's not called the common market, it's called the European Union. But do you realize that the European Union has a military arm? We're watching it at work in Yugoslavia today. It's not directly tied to the European Union, but it's those nations, isn't it? With us. And it says they will attack Babylon. Interesting, huh? We will label that, put that in the file, interesting facts in today's news. It also says back in Isaiah 13:5, remember the far country, we talked about the Medes, that the enemy, the people that will destroy Babylon will come from the far country, from the east. Let's see, where's my map? I think it's this one. No, I don't see colors. Yes, I do. Here we go. The Babylonian Empire is these grid lines around here. The colors don't come out real good here. This is modern Iraq. Okay, Babylon's right there in the middle, right on the River Euphrates. 300 miles to the east is where the Medes were. This is another modern country. Do you know what this country is? Iran. Ooh, they don't like the Iraqis. Interesting. Verse 8 says, and they shall be afraid, talking about the Babylonians. They shall be afraid. Pangs and sorrow shall take hold of them. They shall be afraid. You know what? You don't have to be afraid with all this. These folks will be afraid. It's very understandable. Last week, Isaiah 12:2, behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. Gang, God has His hand on all this. Whether you live in America or Yugoslavia or in Babylon, you can trust God and not be afraid. Verse 9, behold, the day of the Lord cometh, cruel both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and He shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. We've gotten very comfortable in America, haven't we? I mean, the wars are always over there, right? Cold War's over. I mean, who's really the enemy anymore? Economy's doing great. Employment's doing great. We've gotten quite comfortable, you know. I kind of wonder if this situation in Yugoslavia shouldn't be a little bit of a wake-up call for us. Oh, wait a minute, Pastor. This is just another one of those regional conflicts. We're being the world's policemen and all like that. And, you know, well, maybe. Maybe that's all it is. And I hope that, in a way, that it is. This was on the news yesterday. CNN headline news. President Boris Yeltsin, Russian President Boris Yeltsin, warns that NATO should not push Moscow toward military action over Kosovo, saying this could trigger a possible world war. Meanwhile, the Kremlin denied that Russian missiles have been retargeted toward NATO countries. He says this, I told NATO, the Americans and the Germans, don't push us towards military action. Otherwise, there will be a European war for sure, and possibly world war. Now, this could be bluffsmanship. That could be just, that could be all it is. You know, who's Russia to push us around? And that could be all it is. But that's pretty interesting how in the last couple weeks, suddenly people are talking about world war. Would you have thought about it 2 weeks ago? 3 weeks ago? No, not hardly. We could be close. No, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say that what's going on in Yugoslavia is the prelude to Armageddon. It could be. It could be. It could be the thing that could wind up us with a 10-nation confederacy as nations get sick of it and pull out, and who knows. Just interesting stuff going on, gang. Are you ready for the semester test? Whether you like it or not, it's coming. Verse 9, he says, behold, the day of the Lord cometh, cruel both with wrath and anger, to lay this land desolate. He shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. He will destroy the sinners thereof. There will be a time when the world will have to pay for its sin. And it's funny how odd we are. We cry for justice, but we don't often think about what we're asking for. You know, we look here of atrocities happening around the world. We say, somebody ought to pay. You know, hear of a friend, you know, whose husband or wife cheated on them. And, somebody's got to pay. That's not fair. Look how much pain you've caused. And then what do? We turn around and start fantasizing ourselves about affairs. There will be a time when sinners will pay for their sin. That's real serious, isn't it? before you start getting upset about God destroying sinners, you've got to know God's heart. Ezekiel 33:11 says this, "Say unto them, as I live, saith the Lord God, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn away, turn from his way and live. Turn ye from your evil ways, for why will you die, O house of Israel?" God wants sinners to live. That's why he sent his son Jesus to die on a cross, to pay our price for us. There's a story in Luke chapter 7 where Jesus goes over to a man, Simon's house, a Pharisee, and while he's there sitting at dinner, this gal walks in. And the way she's dressed and everything, everybody kind of knows what she is like and who she is, you know, and she's a prostitute, you know, and she comes in and she starts weeping. She takes out an expensive bottle of perfume, and as she's weeping, she bathes and washes Jesus' feet in her tears and puts this expensive perfume all over him, and is just, oh, just kissing his feet. And Simon, who was his house, and he's sitting there thinking to himself, if this Jesus were really a prophet, he'd know what kind of woman this was, you know. He'd say, "Get out, something stinks in here. Somebody take the garbage out," you know. He'd tell her what's what. Jesus knew what he was saying and said, "Buddy, let me ask you something. Let's say a creditor had two guys who owed him money. One guy owed him $50, the other guy owed him $2,000. Neither of them could pay. They both come up to him and they say, 'Oh, I can't pay, help me, help me.' And he says, 'Okay, you don't have to pay.' And Jesus said, 'Which one do you think will love him the more?' Well, Simon thought about it. He said, 'Well, the one who owed him the more, that guy's going to love him a whole lot.' And Jesus is looking at this gal. And he says, 'Simon, when I came into your house, you never bothered giving me the basic customary things of washing my feet, anointing me, giving me any kind of a greeting, and yet this woman has washed my feet with her tears. She's anointed me with perfume, has not ceased to kiss my feet.' He turns and he says, 'Woman, your sins are forgiven.'" Now, when we talk about God destroying sinners, you've got to understand God's heart. Don't jump to the conclusion, the wrong one. See, Jesus is the friend of sinners. Before the destruction comes, there's plenty of warnings, plenty of times where he says, "Watch out where you're going. I will do anything to keep you. In fact, I'll die for you to keep you from going there." Now, when you think of that story at Simon's house, who do you relate to? Do you relate to Simon the Pharisee? "I keep those stinking sinners away from me." Is that the way we are? "Oh, I don't like being with those non-Christians. They're just heathen pigs." Do we relate to the woman? "Oh, Lord, I need you. I'm unworthy. I just want to love you." I think sometimes it wouldn't hurt for some of us to be a little bit more like Jesus, to be the friend of sinners. "I don't care if people are going to accuse me of that. I need to be their friend because they need help. They need rescue. I need to rescue the perishing. Judgment is coming, gang. Judgment is coming. Are you ready? And are there people you need to rescue?